This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support. Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. Today we visit with pianist Stephen Drury in preparation for our broadcast tomorrow night at 8 of his concert given at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton in the Edward T. Cohn Concert Series just a couple weeks ago of a single work, Frederick Jevsky's masterpiece, The People United Will Never Be Defeated. 36 variations on a Chilean revolutionary song. You're listening to the opening theme and first variations performed by my guest. The work cycles kaleidoscopically through every style of piano playing in music history, from Bach-style counterpoint to pointillism, and from stride piano to free improvisation. It's wildly virtuosic, and it is regarded as one of the greatest piano works of the last 50 years. But it holds no fear for my guest, who has made a career of performing the newest music for piano over these many decades. Growing up in the Pacific Northwest, then heading east for his studies, he now teaches at the New England Conservatory. He has championed music of Stravinsky, Ives, Cage, Jevsky, Carter, John Zorn, John Luther Adams, to name just a few, with major orchestras and ensembles and at major festivals and in top venues from Carnegie Hall to the Kennedy Center, winning recognition and definitive performance status for these interpretations in concert and on recordings. His dedication to music unknown or little known by American composers continues to fire his talent and drive. I spoke with him between his two concerts at the Institute for Advanced Study on the stage of Wolfenson Hall a few weeks back in October.
Very happy to be here with pianist Stephen Drury. We are on the stage of Wolfenson Hall, as we have been often here, because you are between the concerts here in the Edward T. Cohn Concert Series at the IAS. Concert last night, concert tonight. The concert features one work. Right up front, I have to say, last night was fantastic. Thank you. It was my virgin experience of hearing the work live. I'd never heard it live.
Oh, then you don't know any better. But it's very kind of you to say that.
But I've heard many recordings, but I've never heard it live. There is a wow factor. In fact, even David Lang afterwards with the little Q&A, you know, the thing that comes to people's mind is, how do you do that? So before we get to the music, this is a piece, and there are others, we'll mention a couple of them, that you probably get that reaction when you play this piece of, wow, how do you do that? There's a stamina factor, there's an energy factor. What do you have to do to gear yourself up to play it and then on the other side come down from it? This is different than other pieces you would play on a normal recital.
Right. Well, to play it, I have to practice it.
Yeah.
It's almost 60 minutes of music, but that's an average recital. Piano recital length. The only difference is it's nonstop. It took me, I mentioned last night in the Q&A, it took me a year to learn. I'm a slow learner. It's certainly got some difficult passages. It's a challenge, but I mean, that's part of the piece. It was commissioned by Ursula Oppens, who has been friends with Frederick Jevsky for ages, since they were young, and it was commissioned to go on the other half of a concert which featured Beethoven's Hammerklavier Sonata, which is 45 minutes long. And Jevsky said, well, in his inimitable way, if you're going to be on the same concert as Hammerklavier, you better be longer. So he set out to write this very, very deliberately large-scale piece along the lines of Dibelle, Goldberg Variations, Paganini Variations, right. That kind of spaciousness without those, I don't think, particularly in mind, but hovering over his shoulder.
When she got the piece, She said she never played the Beethoven. I mean, this was a piece that, of its breadth and dimensions, she wasn't expecting.
And surprise!
Surprise, this will be the program. And disseminate it out from Ursula, then. When you first came into orbit with this piece, through a student, basically?
Well, I knew of the piece. I heard Zhevsky play it fairly early on at the Harvard's Fromm concert series. At which point it was a good 20 minutes longer because he improvises a cadenza, which can go on, you know, until he gets hungry. So it was in the air, and I had actually purchased the score, and 10 plus 15 years later, I had a student come from Japan to study with me, and that was her project, and we spent half a dozen lessons working through it, by which point I said, you know, I really should get on this myself and quit procrastinating, start learning it.
You did it really well last night, believe it or not, and because you did you, from the stage you said, oh, this is kind of, but if you could just for our listeners, the thumbnail, the structure of the piece, it is based on what, and then he structures the variations how?
Sure. The theme is El Pueblo Unido Jamás Será Vencido, pardon my bad Spanish, which is, first of all, it's a very widely known rhythmic chant, the people united will never be defeated. In particular, in Latin America, but really throughout the Americas. The song was written by Sergio Ortega in reaction to coming home after a demonstration in shortly pre-Pinochet,
yeah,
Chile.
Like 69 or something.
Yeah. Yes. So he had that in his head, and he wrote the song out, which we hear at the very beginning, the whole theme. Very traditional kind of folk song structure. It was popularized by the group Quilapayún, who picked it up and did their own version of it and played it. So the song itself is quite well known throughout Latin America, as well as the chant, more widely known. Zhevsky takes the theme and makes 36 variations on it, and they come in six groups of six. And in each group, the first five variations, each one of them has a particular texture or rhythm or kind of tonality or density, something that sets it off, particular flavor. And then when he gets to variation number six, he takes four bars from the first variation, not literally, but in the same flavor, four bars from the second, four bars from, and so on and so forth, and sums up the preceding six variations. So variation six would have a chunk from one, a chunk from two, so on and so forth. He goes that way through each set. When he gets to the sixth set of six, which is, of course, the sixth of the, of the group, he sums up, but he does so by referring back to the first variation in each set for variation 31.
So 13, 19.
Exactly. And then, the second one would be the second set, which means that by the time he gets to the sixth variation of the sixth set, he then goes back and brings the entire, all, however that would be, 25 fragments together, unifying a variation. Of course, that's the metaphor of the piece, the people united.
Right.
In a kind of slightly more macroscopic look, it's also, it took me a while to figure this out for myself, it's also in a kind of a sonata form. The first 12 variations, more or less in a tonal cycle, as a kind of a first movement, expository first dramatic movement. Actually, the first half, I should say, the first 18 variations. Then he goes into a kind of scherzo for the fourth set, which goes by very, very quickly, breaks up what could be a little bit of a predictability of the structure. And that variation 17, it's also where you flip the record if you're playing the LP. And that goes by very, very quickly as a kind of a scherzo. And then there's an extended fifth group, which is more of a slow movement, and also which becomes much more freewheeling. It's filled with little cadenzas, little minimalist passages, stretches which don't follow the structure of the original theme at all, and ends with a very, very short variation, almost out of character, kind of lightweight and little jazzy 5/8 rhythm, which almost says, this is okay, we can do this.
Yeah.
We can deal with it. Then he sums those up, and then he starts variation 31, which is a kind of a final movement, a recapitulation.
Right.
So there's this big structure as well as the 6x6.
There's a couple other quotes some other
there are,
worker
yeah.
socialist songs.
Absolutely, those are
Hans
really...
Hans Eisler and Italian.
Yeah, the Hans Eisler quote and the Avanti Populi,
right,
the
yeah.
Italian communist song.
And as complex mathematically and structurally as that may sound to our listeners, you can hear it.
I mean,
one of the strokes of master genius in this piece is you can hear what's happening. And your mind, which is a long time for recall for some people, musical memory, it takes you back to,
to
earlier parts of the piece.
I mean, of course, this has always been the case with classical forms
sure.
to an extent, but especially in the latter half of the 20th century, so much music has to do with memory and correct or fallible memory. Feldman plays with this all the time. He'll play a phrase and then he'll come back to it, you know, 20 times, and with these little variations, you're never sure whether you're hearing your memory of the phrase or the phrase correctly. But Ozhevsky also really makes each of the variations kind of very particular sound. I mean, there's variation with whistling. That gets noticed right away.
Sure.
There's a variation which is very, very sparse, like more silence. That gets noticed right away. The variation with clusters and slamming and glissandos and, you know, those kind of things really pop into your memory.
The theme comes back at the end, and it's treated as its entity in various ways.
Yes, the theme does come back. The context of this struggle, there's a subtext that I have in my own mind, which has to do with struggle and catastrophe and picking up the pieces and the single voice taking up the theme again. But, I mean, people should make up their own scenario when they hear it. But what we were talking about at first, this idea of, you know, how does one tackle a piece? I told this story last night at the Q&A after the concert. I've been playing the piece for a long time.
Yeah, 30 plus years.
Yeah. I recently played it January 20th, 2017, a day that will live in infamy.
Yeah.
And after that concert...
In infamy, we're still living, by the way.
Well, given that we make it to the broadcast, if the bombs don't start to fall, or God knows what else.
Yeah.
And in preparing for the concert, my 12-year-old, we were talking about it, and he came to the show, and, you know, I warned him, this is going to be sitting for an hour, so get comfortable and try to keep track of... And he said, really, an hour you play... How do you do that? How do you learn a piece that's an hour long, get up and play it and remember it? In retelling the story, I made the point that it's what we are faced with right now, which is you work very, very hard for a long, long period of time, and you just keep at it. It's easier to learn an hour long piece of music than it is to rebuild a society which has been deliberately ripped asunder. But, you know, I signed the papers for the gig, so I had no choice. We're living in this world, and John Cage made the same point when he was making the Etudes Astralis, which is, he said, I wanted to write music that was impossible and then have someone play it and show on stage that the impossible challenges can be met.
So let's dig a bit further into this work my guest Stephen Drury performed at the Institute for Advanced Study last month, Frederick Jeffsky's The People United Will Never Be Defeated. Here are some variations from further into the work performed by my guest on a recording seen by many critics as definitive, available on the New Albion label. Thank you.
Speaking of performances, you also mentioned last night, you performed this for Rzhevsky. Mm-hmm. You even had a performance in Arizona where he was in the audience, as was Ortega, who
wrote the tune.
And that must have been a pretty special performance.
That was a lot of fun, yeah. Oh, and I'd forgotten about this. They also had the university men's choir come out ahead of time and sing the original song I set for a men's chorus. So, yeah, to have both of those composers there with me and, you know, get snarly comments before and after the performance.
Yeah,
and he and Ortega converse in French, and I have to just say that Rzhevsky has absolutely the worst French accent I've ever heard in my life. It doesn't stop him for a minute.
I've met him as well. He is a
character.
He's irascible to it, and that's said with your imitation is good as well.
He's a Princeton boy, by the way. We should mention that.
Okay.
Here at Princeton.
Yeah. You mentioned some of these other pieces, and it wouldn't be out of place to see this as the 20th century's addition to something that started with the Goldberg in the 18th century, Beethoven with the Diabelli. Throw in the Brahms Paganini, they kind of keep the ball rolling. Well, talk about as a pianist, how do you see it in that line of these gigantic pieces which start with something very small, either a theme, a bass line in the Goldberg variations, and grow into something that maybe even the composers couldn't have dreamed it would have grown into?
Yeah, I would say it's more of an exception
than
the rule. I mean, I know obviously Rzhevsky had those pieces looking over his shoulder because he knows the repertoire. And I'm sure there was a sense that he was, you know, responding to them. The Diabelli doesn't have the kind of structure of either Rzhevsky's pieces or the Goldberg variations. It is much more kind of freewheeling and intuitive as it plays. So there's obviously a structure, but it's not this rigorous. The Goldberg variations, it's every three variations has a particular kind of counterpoint. And yes, the Brahms Paganini variations is a big set, but it's also in two books. And again, it doesn't have the kind of structure. I don't know if that's a line. I think there's a couple instances.
Well, let me rephrase that line, but I'm saying this is something that they're rare. Mm-hmm. There aren't composers lining up to do these massive type of keyboard variations.
Well, there are other examples. They just aren't.
They're
not as good, so they don't get played as much.
Okay, fair enough.
Cornelis Cardew has a big set of variations on a worker's song. He was wonderful. I should say no more.
But I'm just saying, I guess the line meaning whether you're around or I'm around, there might be something in the 21st century which will come along from some composer who may not even be born yet that will also be an addition to this. I mean, one can hope that, you know, there would be something coming.
Yeah, I don't. Well,
and the variation form lends itself to this kind of length, is what I'm saying.
Right. Yeah. Whether that's a form that's still viable or not. I mean,
honestly,
it wasn't viable when Rzhevsky wrote the piece. Tonality wasn't viable when he wrote the piece. It's a huge controversy. I was talking to Vinko Globokar, who was at the European premiere. And he said people in the new music community were completely up in arms about the use of tonality and the, you know, the political aspects as well and all this stuff. I'm not expecting and I'm not waiting for something like this. I look for the next wonderful thing, whatever it is. You know, I really would tend to put these more in line with Cage's Etudes Astrales in terms of large, ridiculously large, demanding sets. And, you know, there's a Tristan Murail piece, Forgotten Territories, which is half an hour long and incredibly virtuosic. The Stockhausen Klavierstück 10, which Rzhevsky actually refers to a little bit, because, of course, he played that. And that kind of large-scale piano essay, I see it more as a larger group, and the variations make a particular link to a couple examples. But, you know, I would put it more alongside the Hammerklavier Concord Sonata.
Well, we should say Rzhevsky played many of these late 20th century pieces.
Yeah, he's ridiculous.
He knew what he had in his head. And, of course, we don't know where it's coming from. Ursula Oppens didn't know what she was going to get in the mail from him when she asked him for a companion piece.
I want to hear the phone call. Frederick, what is this? You know, I got to play this in November, right?
One last dip into Frederick Chesky's The People United Will Never Be Defeated. As we come back to the theme after the last of the 36 variations, you can hear my guest, Stephen Drury, perform the entire work tomorrow night at 8 on the next Music from the Institute for Advanced Study, recorded at his concert given there last month.
You study at Harvard?
Undergraduate, yeah.
Undergraduate, New England Conservatory of Music?
I did artist diploma at New England Conservatory many, many years later after escaping from a 1 year of a graduate conservatory program in a place to remain nameless because it was a 2 year program, which will tell you how much I got out of it.
So, piano performance, why the shift, the focus to new music of the time. Was there a point or what?
Oh, yeah.
So what was that?
Yeah, no, and it happened to me early on. Right. In maybe 7th or 8th grade. I grew up in Spokane, Washington. Studied with just a marvelous, marvelous musician, piano teacher, Margaret Saunders Ott, who was Olga Samaroff's assistant at Juilliard, who was one of the Mrs. Stokowskis.
Okay.
And Mrs. Ott would always, because she was so committed to what she was doing, be running late with her lessons. And in her big living room where we would wait, she'd always have left whatever book she had just picked up or was reading. And it was a huge variety. Everything from I'm Okay, You're Okay, and Future Shock, all the way to, I can remember the title, The Origin of Consciousness in the Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind. And these were all sitting, you know, they'd sit. And one day I come in and I pick up a book with a cool looking cover, the 20th Century Piano Music by Peter Yates. Flip it open and there's a little indented paragraph where Yates mentions the famous, or some might say infamous, composition by John Cage, who I'd never heard of at that point. 4 minutes, 33 seconds, where a pianist sits at the instrument, or several musicians with their instrument, waiting to play but not producing a sound. And it triggered me. I was at the right age and had that, you know, was not interested in same old, same old. And I went, whoa. And borrowed the book, you know, covered it completely. Went to the Spokane Public Library and started checking out everything that I could find. They had a great Charles Ives record collection. Not so much John Cage. But that was a little early and the librarian didn't like Cage. But
right.
And started reading more and more and learning stuff. And, you know, it's been down the rabbit hole ever since.
What did your teachers say?
Oh, I mean, they were great. They did what they could. I mean, Mrs. Ott was so great because, you know, I said, I want to start learning this. And for God's sake, was like plowing through Ives' first sonata the summer after 9th grade. And again, Mrs. Ott was this fabulous musician and utterly devoted and brilliant teacher. And she had, you know, given me bar talk and things like that. And I'm sure she knew who Ives was, but had never, put her fingers on the music. And the thing that she said which I still quote to my students, which is still the most important single thing anybody's ever said to me about this music. She says, honey, bring out the melody. And, you know, absolutely. That's, you know, my teacher at New England Conservatory, Patricia Zander, would find things to talk about in the Cage Etudes, for example, about the long notes being on a different time system than the short notes. I studied with Bill Moselos at that bad place, conservatory in New York, and he, of course, premiered the Ives First Sonata and was just wonderful and just kind of listening to me and then said, well, you know, I kind of do this here, and we'd play back and forth. And the only person that I studied with that I never got a chance to play any of this for, which is a shame, was Claudio Arrau. And it's a shame because he was really interested in the fact that I was doing the Concord Sonata. And I'd never found the time to say, okay, now I know you're not going to give me a lesson, because he taught what he knew, which was, you know, 99% of the repertoire up to and including Schoenberg. Right. It was a marvelous recording of him playing Schoenberg Opus 11, you know, in the BBC. Mm. Like, oh my God. You know, nobody knows Arrau played Schoenberg, but this is the way Schoenberg wanted it to go. And, you know, that was a shame. But, yeah, they've all been good with me. And the composers also.
Yeah, I mean, you got to work with the main composers.
A lot of composers. Zhevsky had the least to say, but I will take that as both his way and a compliment. Cage was great.
Yeah, I mean, Cage, you've done all his piano.
There's so much. No, not.
But you're closest.
I've touched on.
Yeah, touched on most of it.
Yeah, and Cage would have things to say like, oh, you're doing that with more contrast than you used to. And that's all he'd say. And then I'd go run off and, okay, this is where this needs to go. Yeah. And some composers would micromanage, like, oh, then a little earlier and a little faster. No, you know.
I mean, as you mentioned last night, and every pianist I've had who explores new music or concentrates or devotes themselves to new music, there's no lack of piano music. A pianist can play anything they want and have a very fine career. Mm. You, however, composer-wise, I mean, the composers that have written works for you, Cage, mm-hmm. John Zorn.
Well, Cage I never got that. He died.
Yeah.
God damn it. Yeah. We had a commission. He was talking to me about it, but it never
came.
Yeah. Zorn wrote Carney and Face of Kvoldra.
Terry Riley.
For me. Terry Riley was, yes, I still haven't learned it.
Okay.
I'm bad.
John Luther Adams, though, for
John Luther
the
Adams
generation.
Did, yeah. Mm-hmm. Lee Hyla, yeah. I mentioned him.
Right. You mentioned
basic training.
What composers, because as much piano music as there is, you could also, if you're concentrating on newer music, even if the composers passed on in the last generation, which composers come into the orbit? What strikes you? What makes you want to spend the time on those composers type of thing? How do you sift through that?
Well, you know, we were talking again last night about composers having their own particular unique vision and liking, as a rule, with exceptions, but as a rule, composers tend to like music that's close to what they're doing, at least currently. Pianists, performing artists, on the other hand, can afford to be promiscuous. I can play a little bit of, you know, John Zorn and a little bit of Cage and a little bit of Zhevsky and a little bit of Ives, who Zhevsky can't stand, by the way. At least that's what he says. He'll say something different any other day. And last night, October 20th, was Ives' birthday, by the way. So it was nice to play a composer that hates Ives on that. Good for both of them. I like to do music that hadn't been heard before, by which I mean, of course, you know, at this point, the Concord Sonata, even the Zhevsky Variations, that's, you know, those have been around. But when they were created, they hadn't been heard before. It was genuinely a new experience. I tend not to get interested in music that is something that could have been written earlier than it was.
Here's my guest, Stephen Drury, in music of American composer, arranger, producer, saxophonist John Zorn. The first minutes of the first movement prelude from his 10-movement Aporius, Requiem for Piano and Orchestra. My guest performs with the American Composers Orchestra, led by Dennis Russell Davies.
many times when you perform or have performed over the years, a great part of your audience, even if you're playing to a committed new music audience, will not know the music you're playing. So how have you dealt with that over the years?
Oh, that's great. They don't know if I hit the wrong notes
that's
or not.
True. From the musical side, however.
Well, no, I try to play in such a way, and this is also true if I'm playing Bach or Mozart, Beethoven, whatever. Actually, I kind of go the wrong direction. I try to play in such a way that it doesn't sound like they've heard the piece. But as the piece is going along, that it's inevitable. Even the surprises are inevitable. I tell my students that, you know, I mean, Beethoven is full of surprise fortes and surprise pianos, for that matter, surprising shifts and all sorts of things. And I tell my students, you have to play in such a way that you surprise the audience, but they don't think you are surprised. That this came afterwards, we know it's inevitable, but not before.
It's interesting if you read some reviews. I mean, you do play what would be considered standard piano repertoire, and there's reviews of you playing Chopin, there's a Ravel, you did the Ravel piano, and some Beethoven. And there's one review, it's not in the review, but if you kind of read it and then know your work at David Lang's, it's almost like the analogy I thought, which could be better or whatever, is like the heavy metal guitarist coming out with the acoustic guitar and doing a folk ballad. You know, it's something you would not expect. And then reviewers like, wow. So, I mean...
oh, he can play key music with key signatures, too. I feel like because I'm willing to play new stuff and because the situation is such that there aren't that many pianists who are willing to play, and especially who are willing to teach and bring their students along to play with awareness and not with a sense of duty. I feel like I have a little bit of an obligation to do that and that I'm filling a purpose. It's like Cage said, he says, whenever I'm doing something and it catches on and other people start doing it, I move on to the next thing. When I was doing electronic music and then everybody started, not everybody, but it was being done by a lot of other people, I didn't need to do it anymore. I need to do something that's not otherwise being done. Having said that, I actually don't see a divide between old music and new music, between standard repertoire and more recent stuff. People say, well, what kind of music do you like? I say, I like good music.
Yeah.
You know, I'm aware of the fact whether a piece has a key signature or not, or whether it's going to chase certain members of the audience out, or whether it's going to let them feel, you know, fat and happy and go to sleep while I'm playing it. I'm aware of that, but for me, it doesn't.
Yeah.
It's good music or not.
Yeah, the old Ellington quote always holds true.
You know? Which is?
Well, there's two kinds of music. There's good music and there's the other music.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm paraphrasing it.
Right.
Any thought of creating? I mean, have you dabbled in composition?
Oh, back when I was young and foolish.
Okay.
I was very interested in trying to be a composer a little bit and in high school, and I did some composition in college. I wanted to be a composer. Turns out I didn't really want to compose. Yeah, I do what I'm good at, and I'm not good at that.
Well, what you must see it in your students, too. I mean, one of the trends of the last few decades is coming back to composer-performer, performer-composer. Many of them are pianists, and many of the composers of a closer generation, you know, a more recent generation, under 40, let's say, are actually composer-pianists, you know, and that's a good trend, I think, too.
Well, I think we should do what we need to. Yeah. You know, if somebody's good at both, I'm not going to stand in your way.
I want to mention two groups that you're such a... Speaking of teaching, it's funny, years ago, on this program I had George Crumb, and he was saying that when in 72 he wrote Macrocosmos, there were like Robert Miller, I think, made the... So like, there are like three pianists on the face of the earth that could play it, and now it turns up on high school recitals. So you still have this Summer Institute of Contemporary Performance Piano, the Sick Puppy.
Summer Institute for Contemporary Performance Practice. Yeah. It used to be piano, but now it's open to instrumentalist composers. And we had to keep the two P's, so it's still pronounced Sick Puppy.
Sick Puppy. How has that changed over the years? Because obviously since that piece that Crumb wrote and there's extended techniques in Nijevsky, I mean, those are all new, and how do we do this? But so much water has gone over that. So what happens in that institute?
Well, it's interesting because it's much, much bigger than it used to be. I mean, when we first did it, I had four students involved, and they were all my current students at New England Conservatory, and we did it for 2 days. And now it's over a week, and we have guest composers coming from quite literally all over the world, I mean, from Europe and Japan, and guests from Argentina. And so there are a lot of people who come who are just interested and vaguely curious in new music, or even have kind of primitive ideas about what new music is. You know, well, I like Bartok. Great, you know, can you play? Here's your assignment. Oh, dear.
Right.
And there are also, and I've noticed this in particular at New England Conservatory, where I get a kind of more general sampling rather than to some extent pre-selected. Some of the students come in today knowing about what's happening now so much more deeply and electrically than I think I did when I was an undergraduate. I mean, it's easier to keep track of course, there's that interwebs thing.
Yeah.
But I mean, I've had students who are like absolutely up to date and teaching me about current trends and composers who have just started to be known as being active. In terms of the techniques, the actual like doing things that are unconventional, there I find myself still useful. Okay, this is how you play a tone cluster. This is how you play a tone cluster so it sounds like it's sliding. This is how you reach inside the piano to make a particular sound. That, you know.
That's still rolling.
One of the things that really delights me is especially the people who come in having a little bit of experience and then go into rehearsals and sit through everybody else's performance and meet the visiting composer and come out saying, oh my God, I had no idea what the possibilities were. And then 5 years later, I see them big in the new music scene in New York or something and exploring all this stuff that I'd never heard of. They just, you know, it's like the spark that sets fire to some of these.
Yes.
And also that the fact that they can meet a senior, you know, established composer as well as composers of their own generation and work with both.
That's cool. A lot of synergy. The other is this consort, Calathumpian?
Calathumpian consort.
Calathumpian consort.
It actually, a Calathumpian consort is a real thing, but you have to look it up. For those who know, it's a shivery. And for those who know, it's a charivari. But those are all Calathumpian consorts.
Yeah.
We are the Calathumpian consort, and we play new music as defined by whatever I feel like defining it by.
Okay, so malleable and whatever.
Oh, whatever I like, whatever. You know.
Complete vanity.
No, I mean, we've played Ives. I've programmed, you know, at Sick Puppy, I've even programmed some Bartok, which is a little long in the tooth. But new music that was new when it was written, but, you know, nothing before 1900. Stuff that still has the possibility of offending.
Here's my guest, Stephen Drury, in music of John Cage, a work for prepared piano called A Valentine Out of Season.
final thing, are there still composers' works which are still on the gotta get to list?
Oh, God.
I'm sure it's long, but I mean, who's close to the top of that list, if there is a list?
Well, I'm still, after a couple of years of working on it, hoping to polish and be able to play properly Helmut Lachenmann's piece, Serenade. And for Sick Puppy this coming summer, we have Julian Anderson coming in, and he's got a couple of piano pieces, and he's a wonderful composer, wonderful guy, and that's on the immediate to-do list. Most immediate, there's Lachenmann's Ein Kinderspiel, which I've taught but never actually played, and I have to get that in my fingers very soon for a concert about children coming up. Past that, the list is too long.
Yeah.
You know, there's so many pieces, but I was saying this is my Before You Die list. But that list includes both Stockhausen Klavierstück 10 and the Bach Sixth Partita. So, you know, it's a pretty broad list.
It's pretty broad list. Well, again, thanks for doing the Zhevsky. I think a lot of people last night really, really, really appreciated it, and our listeners will hear it. And keep everything going. I close all my cadenza interviews by asking my guests the same two questions. The first is hypothetical, which says if you could chat like we've been doing with someone from the past who you never had a chance to chat with, pick their brain. When I ask that, what's one of the first names?
If there's somebody I could talk to.
Yeah, from the past. When I ask that, first one that pops into your head.
You'll
get swamped when you think about it.
But. Yeah. I mean, there's so many composers that I have worked with that I would love to go back and talk to more, you know? It would have been a lot of fun to spend time with Charles Ives.
Yeah.
You know, that's just like kind of the first of, but, you know, really, if I had to choose between, I don't know, Ives and, I don't know, Moses, you know? who is going to have more interesting stories? There's a lot of possibilities there.
Up at the Academy of Arts and Letters in New York, they have his studio.
The studio reconstructed, yeah. Well,
it's amazing.
Tell you a couple of stories about that. It's, you know, probably not have time for, but they're fun. Back in probably 1981, I drove through Connecticut, stopped at Danbury, and went with a friend to the Ives house. And it was kind of set up a little bit as a museum, and there was somebody there, but, you know, not really, you know, they didn't get many people coming through. And I walked in, and there was the little square piano, the old 19th century piano in the corner. I immediately just went and started playing, and she kind of got this panicked look on her face, but, you know, it's like, it's okay, I'm a professional. but also and I'm not sure if it was that house or the retirement house that was purchased outside of the Ives family recently, and the fellow who purchased it didn't know anything about it, but was informed and was very considerate about it. He said, well, I'm going to keep the structure as is. You know, I have to do work to renovate it, obviously. But in the renovation process, there was a lot of lumber that was taken out and put on a pile to discard. And someone based in Boston, who I had given a piano lesson to in the 70s, for God's sake, and this was like 4 or 5 years ago that this happened, went to the house. He said, well, this lumber, what are you going to do? Oh, boy, that's history. Can I have it?
Yeah.
And took it and cut. When you play the Ives Concord Sonata, there's a section which he says you have to have a 14¾-inch long board to play these clusters on the piano. And he cut boards, polished them, and engraved from the house of Charles Ives. And this just showed up in the mail one day.
Wow.
I don't tour with that board unless it's driving distance.
Yeah.
I'm just ready for the airport security to say, no, you can't take this on the plane. But my aesthetic is very, very grounded in Ives. One of the things that powered him was a little bit of guilty feeling about being a musician. Growing up at the end of the 19th century in America, where there's a very strong gender stereotype of, you know, manly men go out and get real jobs. And Ives' father, who he loved dearly, who was brilliant, was like the town musician and choir master and conducted the bands. And Ives wanted to be a composer and a musician and make music. And I think in the back of his mind, there was always a little bit of like, you know, that's not something that real men do. Therefore, I have to do it with a much more like serious, you know, tough attitude. Not exactly that, but still there's a very much a class issue with classical music in America that, you know, I identify with coming from middle class. You know, I traveled to the other side of Spokane when I had lessons, piano lessons. And for me, classical music has to be important enough in a serious way to justify being played and not just an entertainment for the idle rich.
Right. Final question is, everybody I interview in Cadenza fills their life with music. You are busy not only performing pieces such as Lijevsky, but teaching. When you have to get away from music, you know, respite, relaxation, pleasure, enjoyment, but can pull yourself away, what do you do?
Oh, I go to the beach or go to the desert.
Wow.
You know, I just, I mean...
Beaches we got here. Deserts are a little thinner.
No, I go to California.
Okay.
You know, I have a family, and that's a serious life, and but my wife's a musician. The kid is no longer a boy soprano. He had his concert career doing George Crumb, Ancient Voices for Children. He got more work than I did, the little rat. But, you know, for a couple, 3 weeks after Tanglewood is done, and after I do New England Conservatory during the year, then Sick Puppy at NEC, and then Tanglewood for 6 weeks. And once that's done, I fly to California, and on the weekends, I just lie on my back in the beach. During the week, I drive to the desert and get up and go hiking. Just every morning until it gets too hot. Then I come in and I go to the coffee shop and I do emails to catch up for the rest of the rest of the year. But yeah, that's what I do.
Stephen Drury, thanks for taking some time.
Pleasure.
Pianist Stephen Drury. You can find out more about him at his website, Stephen, S-T-E-P-H-E-N, Drury, D-R-U-R-Y.com. You can hear his complete performance of Frederick Chevsky's The People United Will Never Be Defeated tomorrow night at 8 on the next Music from the Institute for Advanced Study. Concerts in the Edward T. Cone Concert Series is curated by the artist in residence, Pulitzer Prize-winning composer David Lang. Lijevsky is the only work on the program, a powerful experience, and I hope you can be there with me tomorrow night again at 8. I'll leave you with my guest performing some music of Charles Ives. This called The Celestial Railroad, a work inspired by Nathaniel Hawthorne's short story of the same name. Ives would later take this music and expand it into his Fourth Symphony. It's performed here in the piano version by my guest today, Stephen Drury. And as always, I'm glad you're in the audience today, and I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past Cadenza program by going to wwfm.org and clicking on Classical and then Webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been the award-winning Cadenza, an exclusive production of the Classical Network and wwfm.org. Thank you.
Thank you.